just moving, leaping from roof to roof, flying over the world below, filled Kyler's heart with joy. Sonaria's buildings had been a mix of Curran-style rice fiber and bamboo houses, with steep clay shingled roofs and red brick and wood homes with thatch. It was rarely possible to move from roof to roof. Here, hundreds of miles from the nearest rice paddy and without the threat of snow, all the roofs were flat and solid clay, supported with good wood. For a man of Kyler's talents, they made a highway in the air. He paused at the edge of a building, rolling his neck and limbering up his back as he scooted back. The gap to the warehouse roof was a good 20 feet wide. Kyler cleared the warehouse roof easily, landing 6 feet in. He hurtled straight at a wall where the part of the roof rose to a smaller third story. It was too high for him to jump and grab the edge. Instead, he ran up the wall as far as he could and then vaulted off it. He reached for the roof beams that extended out of the building, but he missed. His fingers were half a foot below the bottom of the beam. Phantom hands whooshed out from his hands, extending his reach and pulled the beam into his grasp. Kyler flipped up and landed on the top of the 3-inch-wide beam. He wobbled for a moment, then steadied himself and stepped onto the roof. It had only taken him 3 tries. Not bad. Not bad at all. Next time, he'd try it while invisible. He was beginning to understand what his master had told him once about how much he would have to learn once he could use his talent. Just shifting from using his talent to leap to using it to extend the phantom hands was almost more than he could manage. Doing that while invisible and running full speed, well, he had nothing but time to train, did he?
For what? Time to train for what?
The thought soured the night air blowing off in the rivers. The freedom he'd felt blew away like a fog. He was training for nothing. He was training because he couldn't stand to lie next to Aline with his thoughts and emotions and lust warring in him. He alternated between wanting to tear her clothes off and take her roughly and wanting to shake her and scream at her. He feared the intensity of those emotions, feared how they overlapped. That wasn't making love. That he even thought of it made him sick. He leapt across another huge gap. As he slid past a small gang waiting to ambush whatever drunk might stumble down their alley, Kyler was fully alive. He didn't even need his powers. He was just there, every sense attuned, every fiber of his being poised to act. If one of the hoodlums discovered him, he'd have to use his powers. Flee, attack, jump, duck, hide, something. As he slid past a hood holding a knife in one hand and a wineskin in the other, he could smell the man.
Hey! Shut up! We'll never get anywhere if you idiots keep talking!
The hood's eyes passed straight over Kyler. Kyler had to keep himself from gasping aloud. There was something in the man's eyes. Something dark. It itched at something in the back of Kyler's mind. Down the alley, a man stumbled out of an inn. He braced himself against a wall and then turned to walk toward the ambush.
What am I doing? I'm mad! I'll have to get out of here.
He had to go. Now, if they started beating the drunk, he didn't know what he'd do. Or maybe he knew exactly what he'd do, and he couldn't do that. The Kakari oozed out of his pores like a sheen of iridescent black oil. It covered his skin and his clothes in an instant, covered him, shimmered for the briefest instant, and disappeared. One of the hoodlums on the other side of the alley frowned and opened his mouth, but changed his mind and shook his head, sure that he'd imagined whatever it was he thought he saw. Kyler leapt 5 feet in the air and grabbed the edge of the roof. He pulled himself up and started running away. Kyler didn't stop. He didn't look. He was only 4 blocks away, still fleeing, heading toward Aunt Mia's house, when he saw a girl being followed by 3 more hoodlums. What the hell was she doing out this late? Anyone in this part of town had to know how stupid it was for a girl, a pretty golden-haired girl, of course, to travel alone. That was none of his business. Golden Hair looked over her shoulder and Kyla could see her tear-streaked face. Wonderful. Some stupid emotional girl being emotional and stupid. He stopped.
Damn it. You can't save the world, Kyla. You're not really the Night Angel. You're only a shadow. And shadows can't touch anything. God damn it!
In the street below, all four characters in the little melodrama looked up to the rooftop. But of course they didn't see him. They didn't see him drop into the street and start following them. If they caught her, he'd have to kill them. He'd have to hurt them to get them off her. And then, what was he going to do? Beat them up as an invisible man? Let them spread those stories? Someone would connect him to the Night Angel sooner or later, and then everything would go to hell. Now, if they caught her, and he had to break his promise to Aline, then he'd go all the way. So there was only one thing to do. Make sure they didn't catch her. Goldenhair did the first sensible thing she'd done all night. She started running. The hoodlums split up and started after her. Kyla drew retribution off his back, but in its scabbard. He ran behind one of the running hoodlums, timed the man's step, and with the sheathed sword, he knocked one foot behind the other in the middle of the man's stride. The man's partner barely had time to look over his shoulder before he, too, encountered the ground in a far more intimate fashion than he would have liked. Both men jumped up and started running after the girl again, once more closing ground rapidly. This time, Kyla tripped one into the other one. By the time they got up, the girl was gone. Kyla lost sight of the girl and the last hoodlum. He leapt up to a roof and sprinted after the girl. As he ran, he dropped his invisibility so he could use all of his talent for speed. He caught sight of Golden Hair again. She was a block away from the only house in a dim alley that had a lantern burning in the window. Doubtless it was her home. Then Kyla saw the last hoodlum. Coming down an intersecting alley, Golden Hair would have to pass. The man caught sight of her and sank back into the shadows. There was no time. Kyla was still more than a block behind him. He sprinted to the edge of a building and leapt unseen over Golden Hair, drawing retribution before he landed in the little alley right in front of the hoodlum. The man had drawn a knife, and in an instant, Kyla saw from the pools of darkness in his eyes a deep, unreasoning hatred spawned from some perceived slight. The man had murdered before, but he planned to murder Golden Hair tonight. Kyla didn't know how he knew, but he knew. And seeing that darkness that demanded death, it came to him that he'd seen it before. He'd seen it in Prince Ursul's eyes. Only afterward had he decided he must have been imagining things. Retribution darted out, punching through the hoodlum's solar plexus, driving the air from his lungs and pinning him to the wall. Around the corner, a door was flung open, and Golden Hair was ushered inside. The hoodlum was straining to breathe, but he couldn't, because retribution had crushed his ribs and pushed them hard against his diaphragm. The man was already dead. He just hadn't figured it out yet.
Damn me! What have I done?
Dispassionately, Kyla stabbed the sword into his heart. Inside, it was all joy and reconciliation. Kyla felt a surge of pride, followed by disgust at how sweetly domestic it was. But that was a lie. He wasn't disgusted. He was moved. Moved and profoundly lonely. He was left outside in the streets with the dead alone.
Why would anyone destroy a Gakari Neph?
The God King was pacing in one of his staterooms.
The Southrons are frequently illogical, Your Holiness.
But surely these heroes who supposedly destroyed the Gakari, Garrick Shadowbane, Galen Starfire, Ferric Fireheart, surely they must have been witchborn. Not trained as meisters, of course, but talented. Such warriors could have bonded to the Gakari themselves. And they didn't. We're saying that at least three warriors chose to destroy artifacts that could have made them 10 times more powerful than they were already. Great men are not so selfless.
Your Holiness, you're attempting to duplicate the thought processes of a people who embrace the virtues of weakness. These are people who tout compassion over justice, mercy over strength. Theirs is a diseased philosophy, a species of madness. Of course they do the inexplicable. Look at how eagerly Terra Grayson rushes to her doom.
Terra Grayson is a fool, but not all the Southrons are. If they were, my forefathers would have overrun them centuries ago.
Oh, surely they would have, if not for the incursions from the Freeze.
Gareth dismissed that. The average Meister had always been stronger than the average mage, often had more companions in his craft, and he and his fellows weren't split into bickering schools spread halfway across Mid-Kiru. The Caladoran armies were as good as most and better than many. Despite those advantages, the God King's ambitions had been foiled time and again.
I feel opposed.
Opposed, Your Holiness?
Maybe these Southrons really believe what they claim about mercy and protecting the weak. Though our experience here tells me that they don't. But the call of the power is not easily ignored, Neff. Perhaps one saint of their fate might destroy a Kakari that he could use. But how could all six Kakari disappear and stay hidden for so long? You're talking generations of saints, each new guardian as virtuous as the one before. It doesn't make sense. One of them would fail.
The Kakari have surfaced from time to time.
Yes, but ever more rarely as the centuries have passed. The last time was 50 years ago. Someone has been trying to destroy or at least hide the Kakari. That's the only thing that makes sense.
So, someone out there has been squirreling away Kakari for 7 centuries?
Of course not someone, but some group. I find a small conspiracy much easier to swallow than a conspiracy of every Southron saint who's ever lived. Think about their very names. Shadowbane, Fireheart, Starfire. Those aren't surnames, they're assumed names. If I'm right, it may be that Garrick Shadowbane, Ferric Fireheart, and Galen Starfire were the champions of this group. They're avatars, as it were.
And their avatar today?
Now has a name. This morning, my Ledesian bard sang. The man who walked these halls with the Kakari, who killed my son, was either the legendary Durzo Blint or his apprentice, Kyla Stern. Durzo Blint is dead. So if Kyla Stern is this avatar, it would explain why those heroes were willing to destroy a Kakari. Because they couldn't use another. Because they'd already bonded one. They were the bearers of the Black Kakari.
Your Holiness, is it not possible that rather than destroy those Kakari, they kept them?
It's possible. And Kyla might not be allied with them at all.
In which case, they might be trying to add the Black to their collection.
We can't know that. We can't know anything until we get Kyla Stern. My songbird will make the perfect assassin. In the meantime, Neff, contact every Meister and agent we have in the Southlands and tell them to keep an eye out. I don't care if it costs me this entire kingdom. Get me Kyla Stern. Alive, dead, whichever. Just bring me that damned Kakari.
The first weeks in Hell's Asshole had been the darkest, before Logan had become a monster. He'd made his bargains with the devil and with his own body. He'd eaten the meat that came to him that awful day, and when Finn had killed Scab, Logan had eaten flesh again. Logan had to kill Long Tom for that meat, and that killing had made him a monster. Being a monster made him safe, but he wasn't content to be safe. He wasn't content to merely survive. Logan lived with the feral, primal side of himself, but he wouldn't let that be all he was. He shared his meat. He'd given some to Lily, not for sex, as the other holers did, but for decency. She'd given him the advice that kept him human. He also shared with the other monsters, Tats and Yimbo and Nasher. He kept the choicest parts for himself, at least the choicest parts he could bear to eat. Arms and legs were one thing. But eating a man's heart, his brains, his eyes, cracking his bones to suck the marrow, that Logan wouldn't do. It was a thin line, and one he knew he would cross if things got much worse. But for now, he'd sunk deep enough. So he shared for squeamishness, and he shared for nobility. It was his first step to reclaiming his humanity. Finn would kill him the first chance he had. The monsters didn't care, so it was still possible to get them on his side. It wouldn't be loyalty, but anything might make all the difference. Nasher was a different story. Logan stayed close to Nasher. He figured that the simpleton was the least likely to betray him, although he'd learned early on why Nasher had been given his name. Every night, Nasher ground his teeth. It was so loud that Logan was surprised the man had molars left. The third week in, Logan woke to the sudden silence of Nasher's teeth and listened in the darkness. Nasher was listening, and his ears must have been better than Logan's, because a moment later, Logan heard footsteps. Two Kalidoran guards appeared above their grate and looked down with distaste. The first was the one they hated. He opened the grate as he always did and tossed their bread down the hole as he always did. It didn't matter that they knew he was going to do it. The monsters and the animals alike, even Logan, got up and stood around the hole, hoping to get lucky with a bad throw. It only happened once or twice, but that was enough to keep their hope alive.
Watch this.
He tore open the last loaf and pissed all over it, soaking it in urine. Then he tossed it in. Logan, being the tallest, got most of it. He devoured it instantly, ignoring the stench, ignoring the warm wetness dripping down his chin, ignoring the debasement. The second guard looked on uncertainly. The next day, the second guard came back, alone. He had bread, and it was clean, and he threw it to them. One loaf for each prisoner. The man didn't look any of them in the eye.
I'll bring bread with me whenever I'm not on shift with Gorky.
That gave them all strength and hope and a name for the man they hated above all others. Slowly, society returned. That first night, everyone had been so overwhelmed just to have bread that they hadn't even tried to steal loaves from each other. As they gained strength, they did fight. Within a few days, the mute Yimbo tangled with Finn and got killed. Logan watched, hoping for an opportunity to get Finn, but the fight was over too quickly. Finn's knife was too much of an advantage. When the bread came, Logan made sure he got more than most, not only for the status, but to stay strong. He'd already lost every ounce of fat he'd ever had, and now he was losing his muscle. He was all sinews and lean, hard muscles, but he was still big, and he needed his strength. Still, he shared what he could with Lily and Nasher and Tats. More than 2 months in, he made a breakthrough. He'd been feeling nervous, getting more and more on edge about Finn with his damn sinew ropes that kept getting longer. Logan slept and woke to the sound of the demons that he now sometimes imagined made the howling noise. It wasn't wind, he was sure of that. It was either demons or the spirits of all the poor bastards who'd been thrown into the hole over the centuries. His head throbbed in time with the howling. His jaw ached. He'd been grinding his teeth all night. Then he found his humanity.
Nash! Nasher, come here.
The big man looked at him blankly. Logan scooted over and very slowly put his hands on Nasher's jaw. He was afraid that Nasher might snap at him, and if Nasher bit him, down here and infection and death were more likely than not. But he reached up anyway. Nasher looked puzzled, but he let Logan slowly massage his jaw. In moments, the look on the simple man's face changed. The tension in his face that Logan had assumed was part of his deformity relaxed. Logan stopped. Nasher grabbed Logan. Logan thought he was going to die, but Nasher just hugged him. When Nasher released him, Logan knew he had a friend for life. No matter this whole life was nasty, brutish, and short, he would have wept, but he had no capacity for tears. She had to kill Jarl. V stood outside of Hugh Gibbet's safe house and leaned her head against the doorframe. She needed to go inside, face Hugh, get ready, and go kill Jarl. As simple as that. And her apprenticeship would be done, and she'd never have to face Hugh again. The God King had even promised she could kill Hugh if she wanted. During the year V had spent learning the trade at Mama Kay's, Jarl had been her only friend. He had gone out of his way to help, especially in her first weeks when she'd been such a disaster. Because of his handsome, exotic, Ladesian features, quick tongue, intelligence, and warmth, everyone had liked Jarl, and not just the men and women who lined up for his services. Lined up only figuratively, of course. Mama Kay would never tolerate anything so crass as a queue in the Blue Boar. But V had always felt a kind of special bond between them. V stopped thinking. She had a job to do. She checked the door again for traps. There were none. You got careless when he had company. She opened the door slowly, standing to one side and holding her open hands in the gap. Sometimes, when Hugh was blasted on mushrooms, he attacked first and didn't ask questions. When no attack came, V walked in. Hugh sat bare-chested in the corner of the cluttered front room in a rocking chair. But the chair was still and his eyes were closed. He wasn't sleeping, though. V was intimately attuned to her master's every nuance. She knew how he breathed when he really slept. He held crochet hooks in his hands and a tiny, nearly completed white wool cap. A baby's bonnet this time. The sick fuck. Pretending to believe he was asleep, V glanced in the bedroom. Two women were lying in the bed. V ignored them and started gathering her gear. Finding Jarl would be no problem. She had only to put out word that she wanted to meet with him, and he'd welcome her. His guards would make sure she had no weapons, but after a time, alone with him, they'd relax, or Jarl would dismiss the guards and she could kill him with her bare hands. The problem was how not to kill Jarl. She wasn't going to do it. Fuck the God King. But the only way the God King would excuse her disobedience in this was if she could do something else that pleased him even more. V unlocked a wide cabinet and slid a drawer out. It held her collection of wigs, the best money could buy. V had become an expert at taking care of them, styling them, putting them on, and affixing them firmly enough for the rigors of her trade at a moment's notice. There was something comforting about the tug on her scalp of a firm ponytail. Sometimes drawn so tight under her wig that it gave her a headache. At Mama Kay's, V had been introduced to a talented courtesan who told V she could teach her to change the color or style of her own hair with the talent. But V wasn't interested. She might share her body, or Hugh might take her body, but her hair was her own, and it was precious to her. She didn't even like men to touch the wigs, but she could tolerate it. When she whored, she wore a wig for the slight margin of disguise it gave her. Fleming redheads weren't that common outside of Kara. When she was working as a wet boy, she wore her hair in that same tight ponytail. It was sensible, controlled, and efficient, just like her. The only time her hair hung loose was in the few minutes before bedtime, and then only when she was alone and safe. After selecting a fine, straight, chin-length black wig and a long, wavy brunette, V grabbed the cream she needed to dye her eyebrows and makeup to darken her complexion, then packed her weapons. She was tying her saddlebags closed when a hand grabbed her breast and squeezed viciously. Oh. Hugh pressed his body against her back.
Hello, gorgeous. Where have you been?
Working, remember?
Hugh wrapped himself around her, and the revulsion and hatred warred for one moment with the familiar passivity before losing.
You're not wearing that perfume I like.
I've been working for the God King.
Oh, I've been having a little party, celebrating. I got a countess and a... Oh, damn, I can't remember. But the other one's a wild cat. Want to join us?
What are you celebrating?
Durzo!
He released me abruptly and danced in a little circle, grabbing another mushroom off a table and popping it in his mouth.
Durzo Blint is dead!
Really? I heard that rumor. But you're sure?
Hugh had always hated Durzo Blint. The two were mentioned in the same breath as the city's best wet boys, but usually Durzo's name came first. Hugh had killed men for saying that, but he'd never gone after Durzo. If he'd thought he could kill Durzo, she knew he would have.
Mama Kay was friends with him, and she didn't believe he was dead. So she took some men to where he was buried, and sure enough, dead, dead, dead. Unlike his apprentice, the job you fucked up.
Hugh took a flask of poppy spirits and drank.
I was going to kill him, you know, just to piss off Blint's ghost. 100 crowns I wasted in bribes, and turned out he left the city. Ooh, that one was potent. Help me sit down.
V's chest tightened. That was her answer. Kyler Stern was the Night Angel. He'd killed the God King's son. Killing Kyler was the only thing that might please the God King enough for him to forgive her for not killing Jarl. She grabbed Hugh's arm and guided him to his chair, making sure he avoided the razor-lined baby bonnet.
Where is he, Master? Where did he go?
You know, you don't come around enough. After all I've done for you, you... bitch!
His face turned ugly and he pulled her roughly into his lap. The minutes before Hugh passed out were dangerous. He might fumble weakly as a drunk and then use the crushing strength of his talent to compensate and hurt or kill her accidentally. So she fell into his arms, quiescent, making herself numb. Hugh was distracted by her body. He tried to caress her, but fumbled his hand across the folds of her tunic instead.
Where is Blint's apprentice, Master? Where did he go?
He moved to Caernarvon. Gave up the Way of Shadows. Who's the best now, huh?
Oh, you're the best. You've always been the best.
Viridiana.
She froze. He never called her by her full name. She turned warily, wondering if the mushrooms had been harmless, the poppy wine just water. It wouldn't be the first time he'd pretended intoxication to test her loyalty. But Hugh's eyes were half-lidded, his figure totally relaxed in his chair.
I love you. These bitches gotten nothing.
These suddenly wanted to bathe. She grabbed her saddlebags and her sword, then stopped. Hugh was unconscious. She was sure of it. She could draw her blade and bury it in his heart in less than a second. He deserved it 100 times over. He deserved 100 times worse. She took the hilt in her hand and drew the blade slowly. She turned and looked at her master, thinking of 1,000 humiliations he'd inflicted on her, 1,000 defilements until he'd broken her. It was hard to breathe. Feet turned on her heel, sheathed the sword, and flung the saddlebags over her shoulder. She got as far as the door, then paused. She walked back to the bedroom. The women were awake now, one blasted with a glassy-eyed stare, the other one buck-toothed and busty.
Hugh gets bored. I give you a coin-flip chance of living through every day you spend with him. If you want to leave, he's asleep now.
You're just jealous. You want them for yourself.
Your funeral.
Is the Sakage at war or not?
Jarl shifted in his seat. Mama Kay said nothing. She was letting him lead, if he could. The safe house had taken on the appearance of a war room, that was sure. Brandt had brought maps. He was gathering data on Caladoran troop strength, noting where each unit was stationed, where food and supplies were distributed, and constructing a chart of the Caladoran military hierarchy, cross-referenced with where the Sakage had informants, along with ratings of the informants' reliability and access.
That's a more difficult question to answer than...
No, it's not.
I feel that we are in a kind of war.
You feel? Are you a leader or a poet, sissy boy?
Sissy boy? What's that mean?
Mama Kay stood up.
Sit down.
I'm waiting for an answer.
Do you have a dick or do you just suck them?
Are you hoping to get lucky?
Wrong answer. A good leader is never snide.
Jarl stood over Agon and drew a sword.
That's how I lead, Brandt. My enemies underestimate me, and I hit them when they aren't expecting it. I listen to you, but you serve me. The next time you make a dick comment, I'll have yours fed to you.
He brought the sword up between Brandt's legs.
That's not an idle threat.
Brandt found his crutch, stood with Jarl's help, and brushed off his new clothes.
Well, we've just had a teachable moment. I'm touched. I think I'll write a poem. Your answer is...
The poem comment almost set Jarl off. He was about to say something when he saw Mama Kay's mouth twitch. It was a joke. Jarl shook his head. This was going to be a challenge.
We're at war.
How good is your grip on the Sakage? Because I've got serious problems here. Or rather, you do.
Not great. The Kalidorans have had a galvanizing influence. But revenue is way down, and command is breaking down. People not reporting to superiors, that sort of thing. A lot of people think the occupation is bound to get easier now. They want business as usual.
Sounds smart of them. What's your master plan to oppose them?
I had planned to see what they did. I wanted to learn more about them, and then oppose them however I needed to.
Does it strike you as a good idea to let your enemy launch fully formed stratagems on you, and then be forced to react from a position of weakness?
That's more a rhetorical bludgeon than a question, General.
Thank you.
What do you propose?
Guinevere ruled the Sakage in total secrecy, with puppet shingos, right?
Jarl nodded.
So, who's been the puppet Shinga since Kalidor invaded?
I haven't exactly installed one.
Not exactly.
Brand, a little gentler.
Look at it from the street, Jarl. For more than a month, they've had no leader. Not just a bad leader, none. Guinevere's little government has been helping everyone, and so far it's going well. But your Sakage thugs... Sorry, people... have been in the same boat as everyone else. So why keep paying dues? Guinevere was able to be a shadow Shinga because there was never a threat like this. This is a war. You need an army. Armies need a leader. You need to be that leader. You can't do that from the shadows.
If I announce who I am, they'll kill me.
They'll try, and they'll succeed unless you can collect a core of competent people who are absolutely loyal to you. People willing to kill and to die for you.
These aren't soldiers from good families who've been brought up on loyalty and duty and courage. We're talking about thieves and prostitutes and pickpockets. People who only think about themselves and their own survival.
And that's what they'll say, unless you see what they may be and make them see it.
When I was a general, my best soldiers came from the Warrens. They became the best because they had everything to gain.
So what exactly do you propose?
I propose you work yourself out of a job. Give your crooks a dream of a better life, a better way for their children, and a chance to see themselves as heroes, and you'll have yourself an army.
He paused to let it sink in, and soon Jarl's heart was pounding, his mind racing. It was audacious. It was big. It was a chance to use power for more than just keeping power. He could see the outlines of a plan starting to fit together. His mind was already tapping what people he would place in which positions. Fragments of speeches were glomming together. Oh, it was seductive. Brandt wasn't just telling Jarl to give the crooks a dream. Brandt was giving Jarl a dream. He could be a different type of Shinga. He could be noble, revered. If he were successful, he could probably even become legitimate, be given real titles by whichever noble family he put back in power. Gods, it was seductive. But it meant revealing himself, committing himself. Right now, he was a secret. Everyone thought he was just a retired rent boy. Less than a dozen people knew he was the Shinga. If he wanted to, he could just stop communicating with them. If he didn't try, he couldn't fail.
Jarl, just because it's a dream doesn't mean it's a lie.
Jarl looked from one to the other of them, wondering how deeply they read him. Mama Kay probably read him to the core. It was scary. He should have suspected something just by her silence, but he couldn't be angry with her. She'd had more patience with him than he deserved.
Work myself out of a job.
Aline had said she couldn't imagine Sonaria without the Sakage polluting everything. But Jarl could. It would be a city where birth on the west side didn't mean hopelessness, exploitation, time in the guilds, poverty, and death. He'd been lucky to get a job working for Mama Kay. The Warrens offered almost no honest jobs, certainly not for orphans. The Sakage was fed directly from a self-renewing underclass of whores and thieves who abandoned their children as they themselves had been abandoned before. But it could be different, couldn't it?
Fine. On one condition, Brandt. If they kill me, whichever they it happens to be, I want you to write a poem for my funeral.
Kyla sat on the bed in the darkness looking at Aline's sleeping form. She was the kind of girl who just couldn't stay up late no matter how she tried. The sight of her filled him with such tenderness and wretchedness he could hardly bear up. Since she'd promised not to ask him to sell retribution, she'd been true to her word. No surprise there. But she hadn't even hinted. He loved her. He wasn't good enough for her. He'd always believed that you became like those you spent your time with. Maybe that was part of it. He loved all the things about her that he wasn't. Openness, purity, compassion. She was smiles and sunshine, and he belonged to the night. He wanted to be a good man, ached for it. But maybe some people were just born better than others. After that first night, he'd sworn to himself that he wouldn't kill again. He would go out and train, but he wouldn't kill. So he trained for nothing and honed abilities he'd sworn not to use. Training was a pale imitation of battle, but he would be satisfied with it. His resolution held for 6 days. Then he was down at the docks and found a pirate savagely beating a cabin boy. Kyler had only intended to separate them, but the pirate's eyes demanded death. Retribution delivered it. On the 7th night, he'd been practicing simply hiding outside a midtown tavern, trying to avoid places that were likely to bring him across pimps or thieves or rapists or murderers. A man had passed by who ran a circle of child pickpockets, a tyrant who kept the children in line through sheer brutality. Retribution found the man's heart before Kyla could stop himself. On the 8th night, he'd been in the nobles' district, hoping to find less violence there when he heard a nobleman beating his mistress. The night angel came in invisibly and broke the man's arms. Kyler held Retribution in his lap, looking at Aline. Every day, he promised himself he wouldn't kill. Not ever again. And he hadn't killed for 6 nights. But part of him knew that was because he'd been lucky. The worst part of it was that he didn't feel guilty for the murders. He'd felt awful every time he killed for Durzo. These skills did nothing. He felt guilty only for lying. Maybe he was becoming a Hugh Gibbet. Maybe he needed killing now. Maybe he was becoming a monster. Each day he worked with Aunt Mia. Durzo had rarely praised Kyler, so he'd never realized how much he had learned from the old wet boy. But as Kyler spent hours with Aunt Mia cataloging her herbs, repackaging some of them so they would keep longer, throwing out those that had lost their potency, labeling the rest with dates and notes on their origins, he began to see how much he did know. He was nowhere near Durzo's level of proficiency, but the man had had a few centuries on him. He had to be careful, though. Aunt Mia used many herbs medicinally that he had used for poison. She had once set aside the roots of a silver leaf, saying they were too dangerous and that she could only use the leaves. Without thinking, he'd drawn up a chart of the lethal doses of the plant's leaves, roots, and seeds by their various preparations, whether in a tincture, a powder, a paste, or a tea, cross-referenced by body weight, sex, and age of the, he almost wrote, of the deader, and only changed it to patient at the last second. When he looked up, Aunt Mia was staring at him.
I've never seen such a detailed chart. This is very impressive, Kyla.
He tried to be more careful after that, but they consistently ran into the same problems. Over his career, Durzo had experimented thousands of times with all kinds of herbs. When he'd had a debtor that he could kill without a deadline, he'd tried 5 or 6 different herbs. Kyler was beginning to appreciate that Durzo had probably known more about herbs than anyone alive. Though he had usually been hired to kill healthy people, so sometimes what Kyler knew was useless. One day, a man came to Aunt Mia's shop desperate for help. His master was dying and 4 other physicians had been unable to help him. Aunt Mia sometimes did more than midwifing, so the servant had come to her as a last resort. But Aunt Mia had been gone. Kyler had felt too awkward to go to the sick man's house, but after quizzing the servant, he'd made a potion. He heard later that the man recovered. It was strangely warming. He'd saved a life. Just like that. Still, he felt guilty living on Aunt Mia's charity. He'd spent several weeks putting her shop in order because, despite her gift for working with people, her organization skills were abominable. But he hadn't done anything valuable for her. He wasn't making her any money. Aline had gotten a job as a maid, but the pay was barely enough to cover their food. Brayan was getting more and more surly, muttering about freeloaders, and Kyla couldn't blame him. Kyla brushed his fingertips over retribution. Every time he strapped the blade on, he acted as judge and executioner. The blade had become the emblem of his oath-breaking. Not tonight. Kyla put it back in its box and, gathering his talent, leapt out the window. He crossed the roofs to find Goldenhair's house and put everything else out of his mind. He had to worry all day long. He wasn't going to ruin his nights, too. The whole family was there, asleep in their little one-room shack. Kyler turned to go, but something stopped him. The girl and her father were asleep. The mother's lips were moving. First, Kyler thought she was dreaming, but then her eyes opened and she got out of bed. She didn't light any candles. She briefly looked out the narrow window where Kyler stood invisible. She looked afraid, so much so that he double-checked his invisibility. But her eyes weren't fixed on him. He looked behind himself, but there was nobody in the street. Goldenhair's mother shivered and knelt by the bed. Praying? Son of a bitch. Kyler was at once embarrassed and angry to witness something so personal. He wasn't sure why. He cursed silently and turned to go. 3 armed men were coming down the street. Kyler recognized 2 of them as the guys who'd chased Goldenhair the other night.
She's a witch, I'm telling you!
It's true, Shinga, I swear!
Oh, you're joking.
Carnarvon Shinga himself was checking out some thug's story about a witch? A witch? As if a witch would have tripped the men rather than killing them. Kyler looked back inside. The woman had woken her husband and both were praying now. It was odd, because from their bed, there was no way they could have seen the Sakage thugs. Maybe the woman had some talent.
Praying for protection?
Kyler sneered, and the small, mean part of him wanted to leave. Let their god solve his own problems. Kyler got as far as turning his back, but he couldn't do it.
Baruch, what do we do?
Ow! Sorry!
I meant Shinga Sniggle. What do?
We kill them.
Lovely.
They were only 20 paces away.
What if she uses witchery again, Shinga? I ain't afraid of that shit.
As Kyler saw the man's eyes, his hand went to his back. But retribution was gone. His momentary surprise was enough to break him free of the killing impulse. He'd sworn. Damn him, he'd sworn. There had to be another way.
Tonight, there would be another way.
Kyler materialized in front of the Shinga, or rather, parts of him did. He let some light shine through the kakari that covered him so that he appeared with a smoky translucence. The curve of an oily, iridescent black bicep shimmered in and out of visibility. Then the curve of broad shoulders, the V of his torso, the lines of his chest muscles. All of them exaggerated so they seemed larger than they were. They faded in and out of sight like a ghost. And then Kyler topped it with his masterstroke. The kakari became solid over his eyes, making them gleam like metallic black jewels in midair. Then, the rest of his face appeared, covered in a mask of black, shimmering metal molded to his skin. It was menacing. It was more than menacing. It was the very face of judgment, of retribution made flesh. And at what Kyla saw within Ashinga's eyes, hatred, envy, greed, murder, betrayal, the mask became fierce.
This family is under my protection.
He brought his left hand up and flexed it. The Kakari slid out into a long, smoking punch dagger. Low blue fire sprang up in his eyes. The Ashinga shook, petrified, his mouth slack.
Run!
Kyla felt no satisfaction. Just when he thought he couldn't paint himself any further into a corner, he'd done so brilliantly. What had Durzo Blint told him more than a decade ago?
A threat's a promise, boy. On the street, you can lie about everything except your threats. An empty threat is surrender.
Feeling sick, Kyla looked into the house. The woman and her husband were still kneeling by their bed, holding hands. They hadn't seen or heard anything. As Kyla looked in, though, the woman squeezed her husband's hand.
We're going to be all right, I can tell. I feel better now.
I'm glad one of us does.
Not that long ago, you in this room were wives, mothers, a potter, a brewer, a seamstress, a ship captain, a glass blower, an importer, a money changer.
This was Jarl's sixth time preaching, and it hadn't gotten easier. As he looked around at the rent girls and bashers of the Craven Dragon gathered before their shift, he saw awkwardness. They were whores now, and not by choice. Most didn't like to acknowledge that they had ever been anything else. It was too hard.
Not that long ago, I was a bender.
That lifted eyebrows. Though Jarl bet they already knew he'd been a rent boy, he'd chosen the slur on purpose to show it had no power over him. Even among whores, rent boys were second class. They might be adored by the girls, but the clientele treated male prostitutes like dirt. A whore, though a whore, was still a woman. But a bender was something less than a man. That the new Ashinga used to be one wasn't the kind of thing one would expect him to admit, much less announce.
Not that long ago, the Sakage was primarily smuggling riot weed and tobacco and whiskey.
Together, Jarl and Mama Kay had set up a lot of new brothels since the invasion. Most of them barely broke even, but that wasn't the point. They'd done it to protect as many women and men as they could. The Craven Dragon, however, was one of the lucrative ones because it catered to the exotic. There was a girl named Daedra who could have been Aline Cromwell's twin without the scars. Virginal was her gig. Her sweet mate, Caldrosa Wynne, played a Sethi pirate. There were silk-clad Ladesians and heavily cold Modainis and bell-wearing Yamuri dancing girls.
Now, your whores, I'm the Ashinga, and the Sakage still smuggles the same damned things. Like nothing's changed. But I'll tell you something. I've changed. I got out. I'm different. I took my second chance and did something with it, and you can too.
It was the only part of the sermon Jarl thought might be a lie. He'd asked Mama Kay about it.
Why don't people argue whether the earth is flat?
It's general knowledge.
Exactly. The things that evoke passion are the things we can't know for certain.
Like the gods.
It doesn't matter whether you're sure everything you say is true. It matters that you passionately want to believe they're true. Because then you'll be compelling. And in the end, what matters is not whether the girls believe your arguments. What matters is that they believe in you.
It was the kind of thing the old Mama Kay would have said. Jarl was vaguely disappointed. She had seemed different after the coup, after Kyler had poisoned her and given her the antidote. Perhaps the pressure of looking in the face of unrelenting evil was destroying her hope. But her pragmatism had the ring of truth, so Jarl preached on. Jarl hadn't banged since he'd become Shinga. He hadn't slept with a man since he left Stefan's house that night of the invasion, but he hadn't slept with a woman either. He'd survived all his life by doing what he had to do, always building his web of friends and influence, always looking to the future when he wouldn't have to whore. That future had arrived so suddenly, he didn't know what to do with it. Freedom lay useless in his hands. He didn't know how to feel. It reminded him of Harani iron bulls. He'd never seen one, of course, but it was said they captured the young calves and bound them to a stake with thick chains. By the time the iron bulls were full grown, more than 15 feet high at their mighty shoulders, they could snap the chains, but they didn't. Their handlers staked them out with thin rope. The iron bulls were so sure they couldn't get free, they never tried. Jarl had been chained to sex and pleasing his clientele for so long that now he felt sexless. He'd never had a choice before. Most of his clients were men, but there had been women, too, from the entire range of levels of attractiveness. Now that he had a choice, he couldn't make it. He couldn't have said with any certainty whether he would have preferred men or women if the life of a rent boy hadn't been forced on him. The girls at the brothels treated him differently now. They looked at him differently. They flirted. It was terrifying. Flirtation carried demands. There were appropriate and inappropriate responses to learn, and he didn't know the rules of sex outside a brothel. His regulars had always spoken of it as being unsatisfying. But then their experiences couldn't exactly be representative, or everyone would be regulars at a brothel, wouldn't they? He was losing his focus. He couldn't think about this now. Hope had to be sold as a whole package.
Of all the women in the Warrens, you're the luckiest. You are lucky enough to become whores here. Lucky enough to become whores. 6 months ago, most of you would have crossed the street rather than pass a whore. Now you are whores, and I'm the Shinga, and the Sakage is still doing the same damn things. King Ursul thinks you're finished. He plans to let the winter kill off most everyone in the Warrens. He figures that by the time the food riots get going, everyone will be so weak his soldiers will have no trouble with us. He figures that the Sakage is too passive and too greedy to stop him. He plans to split us apart by offering us scraps off his table to destroy each other. The funny thing is, he's right. We've learned that in the spring he's bringing down another army and a few thousand colonists, all of them men. He plans to kill everyone in the Warrens except you. Again, you'll be the lucky ones. You'll be married off to whichever Caladoran buys you. Now, maybe the Caladorans will change and they'll stop with the beatings and the bedroom humiliations once you're their wives. Ursul expects that you are such cowards, you'll hold on to that diseased hope. He expects that sick hope to paralyze you until it's too late, until your men are dead, your friends are scattered, and the Sakage's strength is broken. In a year, you'll start bearing sons for your new Caladoran husbands and have the joy of watching them turn into monsters who treat their wives as their fathers treat you. It'll be normal. You'll bear daughters who will think it's normal to be kicked and spit on and forced to... Well, you know all the things they'll be forced to do. Your daughters won't resist. They'll look to your cowardice and believe that such is a woman's lot. It'll be normal. That's what the king expects will happen. And he's been right about everything so far. Things have changed in the last few months for each of us. For each of you and for me. Now I say it's time for things to change for all of us together. I say it's time for the Sakage to change. We've been at war, and we've been losing. Do you know why? Because we haven't been fighting. The Caladorans want us to quietly die? Fuck 'em. We'll fight in ways they've never seen. The Caladorans are going to starve us? Fuck 'em. If we can smuggle riot weed, we can smuggle grain. They want to kill your men. We'll hide them. They want to conduct raids. We'll know when they're going before they do. They want to gamble? We'll cheat. They want to drink? We'll piss in their beer.
What can we do?
Right now, I want you to dream. I want you to think not about going back to what we had before Kalador came. I want you to dream of something better. I want you to dream of a day when being born in the Warrens doesn't guarantee dying in the Warrens. I want you to dream of getting a second chance and what could happen for this city and this country if everyone got a second chance. Dream of raising your children in a city where they don't have to be afraid all the time. A city without corrupt judges or Sakage extortion. A city with a dozen bridges over the Plith and not a guard on one of them. A city where things are different because of us. I know you're scared right now. Your shift starts in a few minutes and you have to go face those fuckers again. I know. It's fine to be frightened. But I'm telling you, be brave inside. The time is coming when you will be needed. If the nobles want to win this war and take this country back, they're going to need us. And our help is going to come at a price. Our price is a city that's different, and you and I get to decide how. You and I have that power. So, for now, we can go on with things as usual, or we can dream and get ready. Out of everyone in the Warrens, you ladies have the most to lose.
Jarl walked over to the pirate girl Caldrosa Wynn and touched her cheek beneath one blackened eye.
But tell me, is this what you gave up your husband for? A crown for a black eye? One more when they hurt you so bad you can't work the next day? Is this what you deserve?
Tears leaked from Caldrosa's eyes.
I say hell no! You came here because it was the best you could do. You get a crown for a black eye because it's the best Mama K could negotiate. As your Shinga, I'm here to tell you that the best isn't good enough. We've been thinking too small. We've been trying to survive. And I, for one, am sick of surviving. The next time I hear a scream of pain, I want it to come from a Caladoran throat.
Hell yes.
You could see passion burning in their eyes now. Gods, they looked fierce.
For now, just watch. Just wait. Be ready. Be brave. Because when our chance to roll the bones comes, we're gonna cheat, and we're gonna roll three sixes.
Honey! Honey, get up!
Us.
What?
Us.
You do look like someone sat on you. Ooh, and you do stink.
Us.
Honey, we've got to go shopping today, remember?
Kyla
grabbed a pillow and pulled it over his head. Aline leaned over to grab the pillow, but Kyla wouldn't let go of it. So she sang the good morning song.
Good morning.
It consisted
good
of the words good and morning,
good morning.
Repeated
good
37
morning.
Times. It was
good
one of Kyla's
morning.
Favorites.
Good morning. Good
Aline
morning.
Pulled on the pillow and good Kyla morning. Grabbed her and flipped her onto the bed next to him.
What?
Morning mouth.
It was a lie, of course. With the way his lips felt, she wouldn't have cared if he did have bad breath. But he didn't. His breath never smelled. Not just never smelled bad. He could chew mint leaves or moldy cheese and his breath wouldn't smell at all. It was the same with the rest of his body. Put perfume on him and it just disappeared. Probably something to do with the Kakari.
I'll show you morning mouth.
Kyla pushed through her flailing hands and kissed her neck, and then lowered on her neck, and then he was pulling down the neckline of her dressing gown, and her hands weren't flailing anymore, and his lips...
Shopping!
Kyla flopped back on the bed, and she pretended to straighten her dress while she admired the muscles of his bare torso. Aunt Mia had taken Yuli out for the day. The house was empty. Kyla was so cute when his hair was squashed from sleep, and he was gorgeous, and his lips were the most amazing things in the world, not to mention his hands. She wanted to feel his skin against hers. She wanted to put her hands on his chest and vice versa. Sometimes in the morning they cuddled while he was barely conscious, and it had become her favorite time of day. Once or twice her shift had ridden up during the night, and she had found herself spooned against him, skin to skin. Well, maybe her shift didn't ride up all by itself, and she wouldn't have dared it if she hadn't known he'd be out for hours the night before and wouldn't possibly wake up. It made her warm just thinking about it.
Why not?
Part of her asked. So there were the religious reasons. Can an ox and a wolf be yoked together? She didn't even know if Kyla believed in the god. He always got uncomfortable when she talked about it. Her foster mother had told her to make her decisions before she got her heart involved, but that was water under the bridge and down the river and around the bend. Yuli needed her. Kyla needed her. And she had never been needed like that before. Kyla made her feel beautiful and good. He made her feel like a lady. He made her feel like a princess. He loved her. He practically was her husband. They said they were married. They lived together, slept in the same bed, acted as father and mother to Yuli. Probably the only reason she hadn't already made love to Kyler was that by the time he actually touched her most nights, she was so tired she could barely move. If he tried in the morning what he did at night, she'd have surrendered her maidenhead in about 5 seconds. She could almost feel his breath in her ear. She imagined doing some of the things Aunt Mia had talked about so blithely, things that had set her face burning but sounded ever so wonderful. She was feeling so brazen that she even knew which one she'd try first. Did the scripture say, "Let your yes be yes and your no be no"? She'd said she was Kyler's wife. He'd said he was her husband. She'd taken him past the ringery Aunt Mia had told her about, and they could formalize things in the Wadrinner way. Later. Afterward. Kyler sat up in bed, and she leaned close behind him, her hands moving to the ties of her dressing gown. She opened it.
God!
Kyla gave her a quick peck on the cheek without turning around far enough to see the rest of her.
I've got to piss like a warhorse.
He stood and started pulling on clothes. For a moment, Aline was frozen. Her dressing gown hung open, her body exposed.
What are we shopping for?
She had barely laced up her dress when his head poked out of his tunic.
Well?
What?
Oh, Yuli's birthday, right? We're getting her a doll or something.
Yes, that's it.
What had she been thinking? Tenser performed his job capably enough, Wurdmeister Nefdata thought. At one point, he even managed to cough up blood. For the time being, his performance would be remembered as cold-blooded defiance. Once he was exonerated, it would be reinterpreted as brave defiance. The man Tenser was alleged to have murdered, the Cenarian Baron Kirov, had never been found. But on the oath of the Cenarian captain of the guard, who'd said he'd seen Tenser do the deed, Tenser was quickly found guilty. The announcement of his punishment from the God King's own mouth had garnered gasps. The Cenarian nobility had expected a fine, perhaps imprisonment with credit for time already served, maybe deportation to Kalidor. That he would be thrown into the hole was viewed as worse than a death penalty. Of course, that was the point. Tenser couldn't very well infiltrate the Sakage if he were dead or deported. By doing time in the worst jail in the country, he would earn unrivaled credibility with the Sakage. When Baron Kirov was produced alive, Tenser would be exonerated, and he would again have all the access of a Kalidoran duke. But, more important, he would pretend to hold an abiding hatred for the God King for his false imprisonment. Duke Tenser Vargon would offer the Sakage whatever they wanted, and then he would destroy them from within. The God King, as always, had more than one plan. By punishing a Kalidoran duke so severely, he showed that he was a just ruler. The Cenarians who were wavering would have one more excuse to submit. They would go back to their lives, and the noose would only tighten on the rebels as their friends abandoned them. At the same time, the news of Tenser's imprisonment would overshadow anything else. So today, he was releasing dozens of criminals from the Maw and incarcerating hundreds of suspected rebels. With the shocking news about Tenser, people would barely notice. After the sentence was announced, Neff escorted Tenser and the guards to the hole. Tenser looked at him suspiciously. A lot of Kaladorans didn't think much of their long-vanquished Lord Drakari neighbors, but with Tenser, the antipathy seemed both general and personal.
What do you want?
Oh, just to share some news that might be helpful. Baron Kirov has disappeared. Someone kidnapped him, apparently.
The blood drained from Tenser's face. If the Baron was lost, he would never leave the hole.
We'll find him. Of course, if we find him dead.
If Kirov was dead, Vargen was useless. If useless, a failure. If a failure, dead. With magic, Neff opened the iron gate that separated the castle's tunnels from the Maws.
My lord, your cell awaits.